Hello and welcome to another episode of Football Memories and Moments. This time we're joined by Richard Jolly. Rich is a freelance football journalist based mainly in the Northwest. He's written for a whole spectrum of publications, including The Independent, The Guardian, The Telegraph, as well as 442 and The Blizzard. Rich is a very interesting person to follow on Twitter, someone that produces quite a lot of good stats and quite a calculating and clean match reporter, someone who believes in that side of football. So it was really interesting to speak to him about how basically football is effectively supernatural. When we discussed his personal memory of covering the 2008 playoff final with a certain Dean Windass and Hull, and also his moment as well about the beauty of a scissor kick or a volley, and just the beauty of a goal that makes you go wow. Of which we think that they're actually starting to be on the fall or on the decrease, as it were. Thank you again for joining us. I know the episodes haven't been as frequent as they normally are, but it's just about availability, and we'll always put out as soon as we've got one. So on with the podcast.
Well, I've picked Dean Windass's playoff winner for Hull against Bristol City at Wembley in 2008. And the reason might seem a bit of an illogical one. I'm not from Hull. I'm not a Hull fan. I'd probably not thought a great deal about Hull City until about 2005, which was when I went freelance, and I ended up getting quite a bit of work at Hull for the simple fact I suspect that it's out on a limb geographically and nobody else wanted to go there. But then I started thinking about Hull a bit more. That first season that I covered them on and off, they spent the entirety of the season in about 18th place in the Championship, never in any danger of going down, never in any danger of getting above about 17th place. But then a couple of years later, something happened at Hull and pretty much nobody noticed, which again, maybe because they're out on a limb. But Phil Brown had come in, Dean Windass had come back to the club, but they were largely quite a low-profile club, apart from the signing of JJ Okocha. They seemed a mid-table team to most people. And then they only got into the playoffs with 10 games to go. But they get into the playoffs, they go all the way to the playoff final. And then you've got the playoff final at Wembley against Bristol City. Hull, a club that was 104 years old at that point and had never been in the top flight. And the goal that is scored to take them up to the top flight was scored by Dean Windass, a local guy in his third spell at the club, 38 years old, someone they'd released to begin with, and I think he'd gone working in a factory packing frozen peas, and he scores this brilliant goal at Wembley. It's the sense of narrative is almost too perfect in some respects, and it's also the day that I think is the best day of the season. If you've been going back 20 or 30 years, people would say the FA Cup final is the best day of the season. Well, these days, the FA Cup final is nearly always won by a club that would rather win the Premier League or the Champions League. At this point, I think the Championship playoff final is the best game of the season because of what it brings. And because very often you've seen the team that actually is in it is a team that hasn't been in the top flight for a long, long time. So it's added that sense of magic to the achievement. If you think of the year Burnley went up after not being in the Premier League for 33 years, the year that Blackpool went up after not being in the top flight for 39, the year that Huddersfield went up after not being in the top flight for 45. Well, this was Hull, a big city, but a club that never been in the top flight. And Dean Windass scores the goal to take them up there. And it was just, I thought, a fantastic moment and a fantastic story.
So, I mean, For your Twitter followers here, Rich, I think we're getting. I hope we haven't peaked, but we seem to be getting peak jolly. We've got a great example of a moment, but we've also got, you know, you've started rolling out the stats pretty early on, which I'm a big fan of, because obviously your Twitter followers will know you love a stat. You've always come across to me, Rich, as though, you know, your match reports are, you know, the points you make, the very And I could be massively wrong here, so please do not get offended. But it's almost scientific or not scientific. That's the word I'm looking for. People, when your approach to the match report is this is the story and that's it. But it seems to me that you've as you were talking then, you were completely awash with emotion. So what is it about this day? What is it about this game that, and the playoff final? Why do you think that you've reached this point in terms of this is the magic of football now, and certainly in England?
Yeah, I think it's because, I think, as I say, it's partly because things have changed, and the ultimate for a lot of clubs is getting in the Premier League once, even if it is only once. I mean, sure, we can talk about the finances, and these days they call the playoff final £180 million match, and those days it was probably about 60 or 100 million. But I think for a lot of fans, for a lot of clubs, they just want to get up there. They want to see themselves playing against Liverpool and Manchester United and Arsenal. And the Premier League does represent the promised land to a certain extent. And the Championship playoff final at Wembley is a fantastic occasion. It really is the best way to go up. And it often does produce the best stories. I mean, Hull are a case in point, but so are all these other clubs. And yeah, you're right in terms of the match reports. I mean, I do have quite a factual basis to things in some respects, but I also think that we're trying to tell a story. And a story is helped by when you've got characters. And Windass was a huge character, both in terms of his personality and in terms of his career. I mean, he was, as I say, he was 38, 39 at the time. Yeah, this ridiculous strike partnership to a certain extent of him and Fraser Campbell. Campbell was on loan from Manchester United. He's been coming through the academy of a top club. Windass is the guy who's been released by Hull as a teenager. Strike partnership with an average age of 29. Well, normally if you've got strike partnership of average age of 29, it's maybe a 28-year-old next to a 30-year-old. There it was Windass, who's almost 40, next to Fraser Campbell, who's 20. And I think one of the things I like about football teams, and which I think sometimes you got more in the past than you got now, was you kind of got some very good stories. And when I think a lot of clubs had relatively similar levels of ability, it was a lot easier for something to happen at one point at a club and for something special to develop from that, when there wasn't that huge ability gap to breach. And if you look at that Hull team at the time, Nick Barmby was the local lad who'd gone on and played for England and Tottenham and Liverpool and Everton. And Windass had had this strange career. He played in the Premier League, he played in the Scottish Premier League, but he's also had to start out from non-league. But you've also got what you would call a sort of group of journeymen to a certain extent. People like Wayne Brown, who almost nobody remembers, with the exception of his family, I would hope. or someone like Sam Ricketts, who went on to be a decent Premier League player for Hull and Bolton. But I don't think anyone was talking about Sam Ricketts before then. And I think the Championship playoff final gives some of these people the chance to be on the in the spotlight at Wembley in front of 85 or 90,000 people, TV audience, worldwide audience. And there are just so many players who've had that moment at that occasion. I mean, I mentioned Huddersfield earlier, and Christopher Schindler's a case in point. You know, I don't think anyone in England had heard of Christopher Schindler when Huddersfield signed him the previous summer. But they get to the penalty shootout, and he said to the chairman, you know, I'm your record buy, I'll take the key penalty. And he does, and he scores it. You think of Wade Elliott and that spectacular winner for Burnley in 2009. And those are the sorts of players who in an earlier generation might have been scoring the winner in an FA Cup final. That might have been the moment. But these days, the players who score the winner in the FA Cup final are nearly always the sort of people you'd expect to score in big games. The Didier Drogbas, those sorts of players. And so I think the Championship playoff finals replaced it to a certain extent. I just think it is the best game of the season.
Just listening to that, Richard, I'm playing a little bit, but also, you know, we have this running theme across Football Memories and Moments, and it's one of the things I talk about the David Squires cartoons, is that I think, or, you know, your stats or Duncan Alexander stats at Opta, is that ultimately if you boil them all down, I think you have this grain of football, this elements, you know, if you put on the periodic table or whatever. And the way you're describing is that, you know, I particularly like that line you've just said there, that in the past, these were the names that would have scored in an FA Cup final. Do you think that do you think that the football has this potential magic that has to be used, that has to find its way into a story somewhere? And just before we go on to the main day, and we'll actually talk about the memory of the game and the goal, do you think the football's in danger of losing that ever so slightly, that magic from somewhere?
I think so. I think we've got the problem to a certain extent is that you've got this concentration of excellence at the top, which means that the standard among the elite clubs is very, very high. And they're not just bringing in the best players from the country. They're bringing in a lot of the best players from the world. And to some extent, that's a good, it's obviously a very good thing in a lot of ways. But one of the advantages of that is you get this knock-on effect. So there are all these players who in an earlier generation would have been a top-flight player now become a championship player. But it does mean that you see FA Cup finals like last year where Manchester City beat Watford 6-0, even a few years ago where it was Arsenal 4, Aston Villa 0. And the FA Cup, with the exception really of Wigan's win in 2013, and the Portsmouth one in 2008, which was a different type of one because it was the rare final where there was no top six club. But apart from that, the FA Cup final is always won by these same six clubs. And you go back 40 years and the people who were scoring the winner in the FA Cup final were Bobby Stokes, who in some respects maybe had the worst career. I don't mean that in a particularly damning sense, but he might have been the least of the players in that Southampton team, or Roger Osborne, who might have been the least of that players in the Ipswich team to a certain extent. And those sorts of players, with the exception of Ben Watson for Wigan, they don't have that moment anymore. But players can have that moment in the Championship playoff final. And I think we are always looking for where that moment can be and can come. And sometimes it comes, it can come in one league game. And that's another thing you see when clubs like Hull and Huddersfield and Burnley and Blackpool get promoted for the first time. When they have that moment, when they beat a Manchester United or they beat a Liverpool, they can have that one moment there. But they're not so likely to have that one moment in the FA Cup final, and they're not so likely to win anything. I mean, obviously, Leicester in 2016 is the huge exception to the rule. But we have lost some of that magic to a certain extent because the best are just so much better than the rest that realistically they're going to win virtually everything.
Yeah, no, I understand that. And I think you're right as well, though, is that it's almost, I'm not going to go too over the top, but science and magic or faith, they can almost coexist, because as you say, the numbers, these stories exist because the numbers have changed in the league above, because as you say, the players who might have been top flight players have come down. So just moving on to the day. So it's a May day. Traditionally, I don't really, off the top of my head, couldn't tell you a playoff final that has rained. Off the top of my head. So it is traditionally a hot, sunny day. We've all been, a lot of us have been inside Wembley for finals when it's sunny and warm in May. It is hot in there, isn't it? So what was the atmosphere like building up to the goal?
Yeah, I think it was a great atmosphere, in part because it was two teams that had come from nowhere. Bristol City, I think, had been promoted the year before under Gary Johnson. So they had a lot of those players who'd been in League One. And Bristol City, of course, haven't played in the top flight since 1980. Hull never had at that stage. So you've got this great anticipation. I don't think it was the greatest game of all time. It wasn't the worst. But what I do remember is it was a fantastic strike from Windass from the edge of the box. But I also just remember thinking when he'd scored that was the inevitability and that was how it was bound to stay. And I've covered a lot of football matches. And when you do that and when you're having to write something on the final whistle, you're always aware of the possibility that someone could do something to change things. But that game, I just remember thinking, nothing else is going to change this. Bristol City aren't going to equalise or win. Nobody else is going to score for Hull. It's just going to be a Dean Windass story. And I know sometimes people think that we can get too caught up in a sense of narrative, and that might be a fair accusation at times. But that one was absolutely the perfect narrative there for it to be Windass for Hull. And I remember Phil Brown saying after the game that it was either going to be Windass or Nicky Barmby who scored the goal. But if you look at the difference in their two personalities, and Barmby in many ways is a much quieter figure, you felt it was always going to be Windass. It was always going to be him. And it just completed this perfect sense of narrative, as I say.
What was your angle on the goal? Because if I think rightly, the goal was to the right of the dugouts, and that's the same side that the press area is in. So were you behind the goal? Were you alongside the goal?
No, yeah, I was in the press area. So sort of, I think those days they had two press boxes at Wembley, and they're now down to one. But they're either side of the halfway line. So you're side on, you're in a great view. Yeah, and I remember seeing Fraser Campbell go down the wing and cut it back, and always in that partnership, one of the advantages they had was that Campbell was very quick and had great movement, and Windass, very fit for his age, but a player in his late 30s. And what he always had was that technically he was better than a lot of people thought, and he was a good finisher. And he finishes it from the edge of the box. Absolutely cracking strike, the sort of strike that deserves to win you promotion. And yeah, it just felt inevitable, as I say, from then on, which is quite rare in some of these games, considering quite a lot of playoff finals we've seen 3-2s and 4-2s, and it's not often that I felt as clearly that one goal will win it when that goal comes as early as it does.
In terms of the goal as well, is there, I don't know, maybe this is me appealing to the romanticised version where you're looking at this is the clean story side of it. But if you look at pictures of the goal, as I was doing, just as regular listeners will know, we don't do research on here, but I was having a quick look at it, and someone's managed to catch a picture of Windass's just after he struck the ball. And it is the ultimate, I mean, if that had been drawn in Roy of the Rovers or in any of the, you know, like Billy Dane, or you know, any of the football comics and cartoons over the years, it wouldn't have looked out of place. And do you think that sort of thing kind of adds to, as you said, the inevitability of Windass being that hero for the people that he represented?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was a fantastic striker of the ball, and that was one of the reasons why he was able to go on for as long as he did. And in effect, it was basically the end of his career that day. Because he stayed on with Hull in the Premier League for a few months, made a few sub appearances. He contrived to get booked without coming on at Stoke, which was a typically Windass achievement. But what he was doing was he was delaying one of Rory Delap's long throws whilst he was warming up as a sub. So he got the yellow card for that, and then Brown decided he couldn't send him on because he was already on a yellow card. But I think he left in the January, dropped down a couple of divisions. He basically only scored about one or two more goals in his entire career. So that was, in effect, the last one. And it was the one with the most meaning, which, again, just sort of completed that perfect story. And it's also worth remembering that when he'd come back to Hull, which was in the previous winter, sort of 15 months before, he'd come back from League One Bradford. So he'd actually gone up a division at about 37, 38. And then he took them up a further division still.
So what do you attribute that to, Rich? What in your heart of hearts, and away from your, you know, your stats, you know, in your heart, what do you attribute that to? I'm trying to find ways to not ask the same question again, but ultimately it's coming down to is that there is something. I'm a near 40-year-old man about to say the following words, but there is something supernatural about that. Is there not?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things I've always liked about sport is when people can have these moments, and when people can play above themselves, and when they can do it at exactly the right time, it's absolutely brilliant. Because obviously, the Lionel Messis, the Cristiano Ronaldos are brilliant players for years and years. And even beyond that, you get a second group of players who are very, very good for years and years and years. But then there are others who manage to peak at just one moment or in just one game. And it's not always a logical peak. You know, a logical peak for every player would be 27 or 28. In Windass, in Windass's case, the greatest moment comes in his late 30s. And it's illogical. And at its best with sport, there is an element of drama, but there is also an element of someone performing better than they should in terms of logic, and just an element of a fantastic story. And I think that's one of the things we all buy into when we start watching it. I'm not one of these people who wants to see, you know, Tiger Woods win every major, as some people used to like seeing it, or, you know, I don't want to, not that I like Formula One to begin with, but some people seem to like it when Michael Schumacher won every Grand Prix. Brilliant a team as Pep Guardiola's Barcelona were, to me, there was actually a better story in Roberto Di Matteo's Chelsea winning the Champions League. Because clearly, by the standards of most clubs and most teams, they were very, very good. But it was a far better story because they were sixth in the Premier League. They'd sacked the manager mid-season. You'd felt that that generation of Chelsea players would never win it. It was the last chance for people like Drogba and Lampard and Terry and Ashley Cole. And they won it completely against the odds. And I prefer that as a story to a team that is automatically better than anyone else winning all along. And I prefer as a story the unlikely hero to the likely hero. And in the context of Windass's career, to do that at that age made him the unlikely hero. I've picked Manuel Negrete's goal for Mexico against Bulgaria in the 1986 World Cup. And for those who don't remember it, it's a spectacular scissor kick from about 15 or 16 yards inside the box. Took Mexico through to the World Cup quarterfinals, which is something that they've not done since, I think, with their heroic policy of getting knocked out in the last 16, no matter who they face. But that's not why I picked it. I picked it because it's a fantastic goal. But also for me, I think it was the first goal like that I had ever seen. Obviously, that was in an era of much less television coverage. It was the first World Cup I remember. And so obviously the style of play and some of the range of talents was very different to what you were watching in Division One English football at the time. And there are two goals in that World Cup that I think are better than all the others. And the one that most people would say is the very best is Diego Maradona's second goal against England. But I'd seen players dribble the ball and score goals before. Not necessarily as well as that or on as big a stage as that. But Negrete's goal was one that I think I don't think I'd seen anything like that before. And that it was a real revelation to me. And even 34 years later, I think it's a special goal. I'm not sure if it's the best goal ever scored in World Cups, as it was voted a couple of years ago. But I do wonder if everyone voting happened to be Mexican. I do like players who can volley the ball. And Negrete, it's a remarkable goal because he plucks the ball out of thin air, first of all. Then he passes it to Javier Aguirre, the future Mexico manager. And Aguirre puts it back to him at about chest or shoulder height, almost as though knowing that Negrete is a great volleyer of the ball and that he'd almost rather get it at that height than along the ground. So there's something about it is a kind of a computer game type of goal in that respect, though obviously it was when computer games were very much in their infancy. And it's just a magnificent goal, really.
Yeah, it is. This is where when we've spoken about goals in the past, so trying to think who's talked specifically about goals. I know that Adam Hurry has, and he talks about Yeboah at Wimbledon, stuff like that. There always seems to be surrounding context that you can take into place about the goal. And do you think the fact that it was because it was Mexico and because of those huge, huge goals that we had in Mexico 86, are there any, before we had to get onto the strike itself, are there any surrounding aspects about it that stand out to you in your mind's eye when you look at it?
Well, The Mexico element is interesting because, and this is not an original point, but the World Cups in Mexico always look great because of the sun to a certain extent.
Yeah.
I mean, 1970 and 1986, they do just look brilliant. And it's this complete contrast with English football at the time, played in the winter. A complete contrast in terms of the type of player Negrete was and the type of goal, you know, a very, very clearly a technically very good player. I think one of the issues we have with current World Cups, and this is obviously a product of football becoming much more of a worldwide sport and the television coverage expanding, is that there's less a sense of the complete unknown. Now, your first World Cup is always going to be special, but in those days, we obviously had no overseas TV coverage at all. I mean, for me, the last World Cup where fantastic players were players I'd never seen before, I think was 94, which actually is another one of my favourite World Cups. Obviously was played in North America and had a lot of sunshine. But those days, players like Georgi Hagi and Hristo Stoichkov and Romario were players that we didn't see on TV in this country. And so it was a lot easier for them to become a revelation.
Yeah.
And then I think in contrast, I think moving on 8 years is a good comparison, because the Senegal team that did superbly in 2002 were players that most of us hadn't really seen before. But that was because nearly all of them were playing in French football. If nearly all of them had been playing in Italian football or Spanish football, I think they would have been quite familiar to us. But in 94, the special players, some of them were players we'd never really watched before. And to go back to 86, I think Negrete is a player I never watched before or afterwards, because Mexico were banned from the 1990 World Cup. He played in Europe for Sporting Lisbon and Sporting Gijón, but I don't recall ever watching him play for either of those. And so one of the elements that I quite like about it in a way is not knowing how good a footballer he actually was. Because clearly he was, you know, he was good enough to play for a good Mexico team, a team with Hugo Sanchez in. But it's much harder to judge him than it is to judge someone that you watch in the Champions League every season, or that who plays in Europe but never gets to a Champions League club at all. He was clearly a player with a flair for the spectacular. He was probably never one of the world's best players, but in that moment, he scored a sensational goal.
When you think about, I'm a goalkeeper. I still think about making saves. And even though I've had nearly 12 months of retirement now and loving every minute of it. Is that the type of goal that young Rich would have fantasized about scoring, or does it still just stick out for the reasons that you've given, or is that a goal that you think you'd like to have scored? And also, have you ever scored a goal like that?
Well, the last bit of that is the easiest to answer. No, not remotely. I once did a volley where I felt like I cushioned the ball perfectly and struck it sweetly. I felt like Dennis Bergkamp for about 24 hours, even though it didn't actually go in. It came back off the post. But
Cantona, Rich used to say that was better. It worked. It used to look more beautiful.
Yeah, but I mean, I like volleys, and I think they are the best type of goal where possible. I mean, I like goals that feel like they've come from this extraordinary technique and vision, and Bergkamp's a case in point. I've been watching some of Negrete's other goals on YouTube, and this probably isn't the best goal he scored. But there is a common denominator, which is that he quite likes juggling with the ball in and around the box, which is very, very rare. And he likes volleys. There are one or two times where he doesn't just do a scissor kick, he does an overhead kick. So this is very much his sort of party trick, his special talent. And like I say, Aguero seemed to be quite happy to put the ball to him at chest or shoulder height, whereas he'd know with another player that they wouldn't want that.
Does that instantly raise a player above another player for you if they have the ability to hit strike, hit volleyed or scissor kicked or overhead kick goals like that? So, you know, I've supported Everton through quite a lot of barren years, and you know, our opportunities for good things are good. But I know that Cahill used to be quite good at overhead kicks, and I used to think, well, that makes him better than X player because he could do that. Is that something that, is that a logic you apply?
Yeah, absolutely. But to go back to what I was saying earlier about being not sure how precisely how good he was, I also like players who maybe aren't world class in their own right, but who have the capacity to do something spectacular on some of those occasions. And I was trying to think of a good example of it. And the one I came up with is Luis Garcia, formerly of Liverpool, who did have, he had a brilliant season in the year that they won the Champions League under Rafa Benitez in 2004-05. And he scored a couple of fantastic long range goals in the Champions League. But even then, you probably wouldn't say at any stage he was one of the best players in the world in his position. But he was one who had that capacity to do something brilliant. And I think that's maybe what you see with Negrete in that instant, and maybe from these YouTube clips that I've seen of him, that maybe he had in other occasions. And I do like that. I like the unpredictability of it. I like the way that someone can do something remarkable to win a game, even if they're not necessarily the best player around.
I would like to get into the nitty-gritty, which I'd say I've spent the last 2 minutes listening to you, but also seeing if I could work that into a pun, but I don't think I can pronounce his name properly anyway. But the nitty-gritty of it, when someone strikes a scissor kick, do you want to see that player straight back up and celebrating, or do you want to see her lay on the floor, everyone adore me type celebration? Because I think that if we're getting into the nitty-gritty, these are things that matter.
Yeah, I think if it was me, I'd just lie on the floor. Partly because the other thing is like Mexico in June in you know, 90 degree heat, you'd imagine the ground's pretty hard. So to land on it having done a scissor kick, I just think I'd be aching.
Yeah, one of the players, how did he enjoy his goal? All we could hear him shouting in Spanish was, "It really hurts." In terms of your other sort of favourite World Cup goals then, and you weren't dismissive of Maradona's dribble, but you have seen a dribble. But sometimes do you look at, because we've all seen volleys, we've all, you know, you say that you've seen a player do something before, for example, Shearer. When Shearer used to volley goals, it got to the point towards the end of his career where we were like, oh, he's done it again, oh, that's great. But do you still get excited when you see massively, you know, goals that are out the ordinary now, just because, you know, you watch football every week, you know, sometimes more than 3-4 nights a week because of your job. Do you still get excited by goals?
Yes. Yeah, the best ones I do. Yeah. I mean, to go back to your point about the favourite World Cup goals, I mean, I'd say my favourite ever one, which is probably a lot of people's favourite ever one, was Dennis Bergkamp against Argentina, which again had an element of a volley. It had the absolutely perfect piece of control. And I think that was one of the things about Bergkamp, was just he had that touch that was just pure perfection. But it was also the moment, because it was, you know, right at the end of the game, 1-1 against one of the best teams in the world. But yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of one or two goals that I've seen that have really excited me. I mean, for different reasons. I'm going to name two Liverpool ones, despite not being a Liverpool fan. And one was the Sadio Mane goal against Bayern Munich last season.
Yeah.
Because again, it was a really unlikely goal. And I've seen thousands and thousands and thousands of goals, either in the flesh or on TV over the years. And so to excite you, I think you sometimes need it to be very different. And that was a goal that I've not seen too many goals like that. And when they come out of the blue. And the other one, for different reasons, and I was there, unlike in Munich, was the Divock Origi goal against Barcelona from the Alexander-Arnold corner. And that was because of everything. It was because of the atmosphere. It was because of the unlikely task. It was because of the strange way that only two people on the entire pitch were switched on, and they were Alexander-Arnold and Origi. And that, in the broader scheme of things, was not a great goal. That was a great bit of circumstances more than anything else. But yeah, the best goals, I think, are the completely unlikely goals. And I take your point about Alan Shearer. His volleys were absolutely brilliant, but they weren't unpredictable. I mean, the best one, I think, was probably against Everton. I think you'll correct me if I'm wrong here, but yeah. Where he just hit it so incredibly hard that it was absolutely fantastic. But Shearer would score a certain type of volley, and I don't think Shearer would have scored the volley that Negrete scored. I don't think he would have attempted it. I'm not sure he would have scored the Van Basten volley, which is probably the, you know, with respect to Dennis Bergkamp, is probably the greatest goal in any international tournament. So you're thinking of types of volleys, and it's the unlikely ones that really stand out. And I still think that Negrete one is a very unlikely one. There's not many goals like that. The Van Basten one is obviously very unlikely because of everything, you know, including, of course, the occasion. And the Bergkamp one is a very unlikely one. So the goals most likely to excite me are the ones where you think it's a long, long time since I've seen anything remotely like that.
Do you think football's lost the exceptional? I mean, I also take your point about the circumstance around the Origi goal, mainly down because of Trent Alexander-Arnold. But in terms of, I was looking at Ronaldo's goal today, which was the first ever winner of the Puskas Award. You know, I adore Alan Partridge, and I would hope most of our listeners and yourself would know that Alan Partridge is a guy to the 1994 World Cup, where, you know, for me, a good old fashioned traction engine goal. I don't think we see much of them anymore. I don't know. Maybe I'm right. Is that, you know, do we see those goals anymore? And also, have you ever stood up like Max von Sydow in The Great Escape and just started clapping a goal? Is that something, or have you always maintained your professionalism?
Not in a press box. No. I've never stood up or never cheered a goal in a press box at all. In terms of your point about some of the spectacular goals, we have actually seen a decline in long range shooting, and the statisticians can prove this. And I think one of the reasons is that they proved that statistically it was quite inefficient. And I think that got communicated to a lot of the players. And if you think back 10 years or so, Arsene Wenger's Arsenal were always accused of trying to walk the ball into the net. And at times they were doing, but I suspect it was also the case that Wenger was probably switched on enough to trends to say, look, if we have a go from these positions out here, you've got about a 1% chance of scoring. And so don't do it. Work yourself into a position where you've got a 20% chance, a 30% chance of scoring. But of course, it's the unlikely goals that we treasure and that we remember. The counter argument, I suppose, is that you can just waste a lot of promising positions. You could have the career of Charlie Adam booting the ball over the bar from any number of situations whilst all his teammates look on thoroughly annoyed that they're free and he hasn't passed the ball to them. Or to use an example of a player I think of a lot more favourably, partly due to his magnificent looks, Trifon Ivanov of Bulgaria in the 1990s, who seemed to think he had to shoot the moment he entered the opposition's half. And every single shot of his that I saw went nowhere near the goal. But maybe there's some Bulgarian league games where he's put the ball in the top corner from 45 yards and some Bulgarian fans think that's the greatest goal ever. But these days, he'd probably be confronted with the evidence that it never went in when he did that. And so to just pass it and work the ball into the box and give someone a tap in, which is a lot more efficient and better for the team, but does mean that I think you get fewer people taking on these unlikely situations.
Thanks very much for that, Rich. Another fantastic chat, I felt. And wasn't a direction I was expecting this to go in, because, you know, if you look at Rich's stats or his tweets on Twitter, and it is very much about statistical analysis and what football does there. But then for Rich to pretty much agree that sometimes there is no explaining football whatsoever. And as you know, I subsequently, when I spoke to my brothers after the podcast, and my, you know, my football knowledgeable support knowledgeable football brothers, sorry, and they were like, yeah, there's absolutely no explanation sometimes for something. You can do all the practice in the world, and there's no explaining that a 38-year-old journeyman who stepped up a division scores a winning goal with a volley that, picturesque-wise, is straight out the pages of the Roy of the Rovers. So, absolutely fantastic. Really enjoyed that. So, again, thank you very much for joining us. Rich is available on Twitter at rich_jolly. He's also available on Instagram, where he's carved out his own niche of exotic places from across the world. I'll let you go and chase that up. I think it's the same handle. And yeah, thanks again. Tell everyone that, you know, there's a new pod out. Please go rate and subscribe, all that palaver, and, you know, just get the message out, and hopefully we can start bumping up the guests again. But whenever we've got one, we'll get out and we'll get it for you. All right, so thanks again, and take care.